And I understand you've just been learning about Stefanius, which is in Abu Dhabi. You're located here at Gantus. This used to be a designated reserve, but when the Kira were given the whole waterfront to develop, this was undesignated. So this little remnant here is what was left from a reserve that was linked to the Marine Reserve. Now the Marine Reserve still exists, and when Nikhil took over the Marine area and the waterfront area, Palm Jebel Ali, in 1998, the Marine Reserve was reclassified. So all this bit of sea from Gantu, the Abu Dhabi border, all the way through to Palm Jebel Ali is a Marine Reserve. And it's Abu Dhabi's only Marine Reserve. And the reason it was designated a reserve was because it has very good corals. Back in 1996, there were 34 species of coral. But in 1996, there was an El Nino, a very hot, warming event. Perhaps linked to climate change, we don't know. But there's been a regular pattern of warming events, 96, 98, and 2002. And after the 1996 warm event, which is the worst one, very big, very, very hot summer, temperatures of 39, which is like having a bath, a lot of the corals died, and after that date there are only 29 species. So it went from 34 species to 29. And the sensitive corals are the table corals, the ones that sort of come up like a mushroom and they form these flat areas of coral, hence the name table, because they're like a table. Those are the ones that are very sensitive. And in local waters, they grow extremely quickly. A coral, these table corals, can grow a quarter of a centimetre, that's about this big, a week in optimum conditions. That makes them the fastest growing corals in the world. Now the other type of corals, they call them brain corals, because they look a bit like a brain. Those are much more slow growing. So the pattern of coral development here is to have this catastrophic die-offs of all the table corals, and then the ones underneath, like a rainforest, are underneath the canopy of the table corals. They're the much more slow-growing ones. They tend to survive these warming events. So after all the table corals have died off, they're still there and they flourish for a while. But then these very fast-growing, sensitive corals, they start rapidly growing again and they take over again. So there's a sort of 15 to 20 year cycle of coral growth. Because this all happens here, all the way from Gantu, right the way through to Palm Jebel Ali, that's why it was designated as a marine park. And some argue that it's the best example in all the Gulf. So of all the areas of the full waters of the Gulf, this is one of the best examples of coral reefs. You have to remember that the Gulf area is relatively recent. 20,000 years ago, all of the Gulf of Arabia was dry. And it takes many, many years for species to evolve. On average, about a million years. So 20,000 years is nothing in terms of evolution. So there are no what we call endemic species, species that are only found in the seas of the Gulf. The species that we find here have all come in from the Arabian Sea. And because conditions in the Gulf are very hostile, very, very hot, hotter than anywhere else, so it is the hottest sea on the planet that's linked to oceans. And because it dries up and gets very salty, because the water evaporates off, that again makes it very hostile. So you've got very hot, very hostile water. Only a few of the species that live in the Arabian Sea, which is on the east side of the Arabian continent, only a small number can come in and colonize. But that's a small number for what is a hotspot on the planet. And by a hotspot, I mean the waters in the Arabian Sea off Muscat are in the top 10 in terms of biodiversity for marine life. So there are more fishes there than elsewhere. Now, everyone tends to think of hotspots as places like Indonesia and the Philippines, which are indeed amongst the hotspots, because they've always been around tropical areas, they've always been warm, always good for fishes to develop, corals to develop. Muscat is also a hotspot. So even though we've got a subset of all the animals and plants and marine life that's come into the Gulf, it's still very rich because it's such a rich area outside in the Arabian Sea. So we're tasked with looking at those custodians of this area, which we hope to get redesignated as a terrestrial reserve, because the habitats here are linked to the marine environment. What you see here is coastal drift, so you get a sandy spit. So if you look towards Dubai from here, you'll see this long spit of sand and a lagoon inside. Now that's an entirely natural habitat. Many, many fishes use these lagoons as nursery grounds. Lots of breams, sea breams, and various other species. The other lagoons you'll see going more landward, if you walk around the reserve, you'll see lots of other lagoons. They're man-made, and they were made because of the need for sand in front of the hotels. If you put desert sand in front of a hotel, make a beach, you get stained with manganese and iron and get very dirty. And that's what they did when they first started developing tourism in Dubai. So you can't use desert sand. What you need is this natural sea sand, which is built up over thousands of years in this area. So they went and dug out sand that can be useful for making beaches in front of hotels from here. But those excavated areas link into the lagoon system. So it supplements this very nice natural lagoon system with what are quasi-natural, so almost natural, lagoon systems within the reserve. So we have some very nice rich habitats which cannot be found in Abu Dhabi. Sometimes when Abu Dhabi people went to see what a natural lagoon system is, they come here. Sometimes they want to try and recreate these types of ecosystems in the developments that are taking place in Abu Dhabi. So hopefully, we'll be cataloguing all the fauna and flora, and we'll try and make a case for when they redesign the development, because of the credit crunch, things tend to be on hold, and there's likely to be a rethinking of just how much development is going to be. Our wish is that we can make this permanently protected area. In the original plans, this area would have been part of an industrial area, a sort of support industry for mending ships and repairing ships. So quickly just to go through here, because when I was your age, I wanted to be out there seeing what's going on. So I'll quickly go through what we do. There's 11 tasks we do for Nakheel, which is the developer who owns this area. And they principally involve cleaning the beaches, cleaning the sea, checking on the turtles. Last year we had 10 turtle nests, so it's a little surprise for some people to know that we still get regular turtles nesting here. And that you've probably heard this already, this is the Hawksbill turtle. And we also have lots of green turtles that feed here. Green turtles feed on seagrasses. And Hawksbill turtles live amongst coral reefs and feed on invertebrates, crunch off mollusks and various things. So we have both turtles here, but only the Hawksbill turtles and nests. And there's two seagrass plates. There's one directly at 90 degrees to where we are here now. There's a large seagrass area. And there's another seagrass area towards Jebel Ali Hotel. Many more seagrass areas in Abu Dhabi, but we do have two natural areas here. And within the palms, certainly within Palm Jebel Ali, because they've trapped the water and there's less movement, we're seeing the habitat change from what was coral reef to seagrass. So a new habitat is being formed there. And it's still quite a healthy habitat because the water quality is still very good. And that's another task we do for the field is check on the water quality, make sure the water quality is okay. And that's a function. Statutory function. The Keel as a developer is required to do an environmental impact assessment and then implement a management plan which involves checking on various ecological determinants such as water quality. Macroalgae removal. When dredging first takes place, marine sediments and deposits are sucked up from the sea, deeper, much further out than here, maybe 20 kilometres out, sucked up into big hoppers And these ships come in and spray it, and dump it, and reclaim the land. And because this sediment has built up over millions of years, it's quite rich in organics. All the things that have died and settled on the seabed, all the organic material is still amongst the sediments that are extracted. So when they're built onto the land here, there's a lot of nutrients, phosphate and nitrate. And nutrients are what stimulates plant growth, and in particular, filamentous algal growth, which can be a problem. So by removing the macroalgae, this blanket weed, we can nutrient strip, so we can physically remove the nutrients along with the weed. So that we've been doing that for the last 2 years, and we're seeing that the build-up of nutrients is disappearing. The amount of algae, macroalgae developing is reduced, and it's returning to a natural system, a much healthier system. So this is all the waste, masses and masses of waste. This particular one is not from here, but it shows you what happens to birds. This is an albatross, and they cannot help themselves picking up bits of plastic that float on the sea. And this is a chick, and all this is what the parent bird has forced down into the young chick. So the bird is confused, it thinks these are fish, and of course this has choked the bird, it's died, and it's left this debris behind. And invariably you find all these cigarette lighters and bits of plastic that float on the surface. So plastic is very damaging to the marine environment. It kills a lot of animals, it kills a lot of marine life. So we get involved in cleaning up all the rubbish from the sea and from the beaches. A lot of seabirds nest here. And this is the monthly sums. We get about 4 to 8 tons of material each month. Macroalgae, I mentioned, this is where the macroalgae builds up in between these fronds. And over the years, we hope to reduce the amount of nutrients by removing the macroalgae. Next. Now, the turtle monitoring. As I mentioned, we have 10 nests here. Occasionally, we have to relocate the nest. Now, we don't like to do this, because nature knows how to do things best. And if we relocate a nest, the temperature of the nest is very important. If it's too hot, you get all females. If it's too cold, you get all males. So around about 30 degrees is perfect. You get about half males, half females. So it's very difficult for us to get the right temperature if we dig a hole and put the eggs in. We might have all males or all females. Or none at all. If the temperature's too cold or too hot, the eggs fail. But we have some very smart foxes around here. This is the Arabian red fox. Same fox that you get in France, but a sort of desert version. And these are very clever. They dig up the nest. They find out where the turtle's nesting. So if we can't protect them, we have to relocate it here. And we did that with one nest last year, which provided quite a good environmental day for people, because we told the members logged on to the MEG web pages. And many people turned up and saw the little turtles come out of the nest and hurtle down to the sea. It was quite a good day. We get about, on a good nest, 80, 90, maybe 100 eggs, and maybe 80 or so, of course, a tessellate hatch, if it's good hatching. This is the water quality monitoring. You can see we monitor all around where there may be development activity, and get a general idea of water quality throughout the whole area.
Ça, c'est le fan Jebel Ali.
You are here. This, if you look out, you will see in that direction this island here. And just behind it, you will see another island where a big vessel is moored. You can just see that vessel, the Poseidon. And these you can't see because these, although a lot of them have been constructed, they're all underwater. There's nothing above surface. And this has been completed. This is the largest reclamation in the world. There is nowhere as a single reclamation that's bigger than this. This is 27 kilometres of breakwater, rocky sort of habitat, and 12 square kilometres of land. So it is a very large structure. Very shortly, you'll be able to go out and see some of the habitats around here. Lots of mangroves. There's only one mangrove that grows in the UAE. Historically, there was another one. And one of the reasons for that is mangroves like, although they grow in salty water, they do like to be flushed with fresh water. And we don't get any flushing of fresh water here, so that limits the numbers of mangrove species that can grow. They have to be very tolerant and can put up with salty water all the time. And this is the one that does that. This is the grey mangrove, the white mangrove, Abyssinia. And we've been planting this here to try and establish more mangroves in the root systems. And the mangrove root systems are very good for nursery for fish. Lots of young fishes like to grow amongst the roots. And Humur, you may be familiar with, the grouper here that everyone likes to eat. The number one fish in the UAE. The big adults, and the once they get about this size, will feed on the mangrove, on the coral reefs. But the small ones live in the mangroves, so they're just an example of how important they are for as a nursery function. We have three species of dolphins that regularly occur. Longnose, Indo-Pacific bottlenose dolphin, a humpback dolphin, Indo-Pacific humpback dolphin, and a common bottlenose dolphin. And they sometimes even come in the palm, and they're regularly seen in the area. Now, this is something that occurs at this time of year, and it's botulism. You may have heard of it. There used to be a problem with Canadian salmon at one time, many years ago, when I was a small boy. And they heated the salmon up to 100 degrees, but the botulinum bacterium is capable of surviving that. So a lot of people died from eating tinned salmon because of contamination with this bacterium. Botulinum bacterium lives on rotting chicken, things like that, and so you find it at the tips. And birds like these seagulls like to feed at the tip. And if the tip isn't managed very well, botulism, bacteria, start growing on the rotting animal meat, and then the birds eat the meat and they accumulate this toxin, botulinum. Now botulinum, if I had a handful of botulinum toxin, 500 grams in weight, which I could just hold like this small brick, that would be enough poison to kill every single person on the planet. It's that toxin. And these small birds eat a very tiny amount and it paralyzes them. They haven't the energy to pick up their wings and the lungs stop working and they just asphyxiate. And last year there were thousands dying and we sent them away to the equine lab. This is the Shakes lab towards the Sapa Park area. And they confirmed using a mouse assay that these were in fact dying of botulinum. And we spoke to Prime Minister Powers, who offered many of the tips here to try and improve the management of the tip, to try and make sure that the fresh refuse is covered. And this year's been very good. We've only had two deaths. Last year at this time there were thousands, and now we've only seen two deaths in the area. But another example of wildlife monitoring. These are birds that nested beginning in 2007, and they repeated in 2008 and 2009, and they are the first nesting birds in Dubai of these terns. And three species. This is the lesser crested tern, the white-cheeked tern, and there's a very small one, just a tiny one, very fast wing beats. And all three of those nested for the first time on these new man-made structures. So if you provide the right habitat, you can introduce very usable spaces for wildlife. We've had something like 125 species of fish in the last year, and they include these eagle rays, which globally are endangered now. So the fishing practices here are very friendly to fish. They're not, no industrial trawling, no use of tangle nets, the monofilament nylon nets, these are all very damaging. So the wildlife here is very good. There's some of the best ray fisheries left, which is a problem elsewhere. And this new habitat that's in the palm we've got something called a fan clam that's developing there. This is a very large mussel, good to eat, Chinese love to eat it. So it's not all bad news. Although some of the very nice coral reefs have been lost, the new habitats are still useful habitats in themselves. They certainly don't have the biodiversity of coral reefs, but they still can be productive habitats, producing seagrass and mollusks for use for consumption. So this is enough to develop a fishery. We produce monthly reports and give all the information to Nikhil, and we try and disseminate what interesting information we find, and Nikhil are happy for us to provide data to the public. We have done a large coral translocation exercise, but I'm sure you'd much rather get outside. So I'll very briefly just mention that because of the destruction activity, we have got involved in translocating corals from areas that are going to be destroyed, physically destroyed, onto the breakwater. So we've removed where there was a breakwater being constructed here. We moved the corals that would have been dredged and built on and moved them to here. Because this is finished now, Kanjo Valley. And we've created a 4 kilometre coral reef along this part of the breakwater. And it's been quite successful. After 1 year of post-transplantation, more than 95% of the corals are still living. So it proved. That's what the sort of original habitat was. So we moved all these corals onto this breakwater. We use epoxy, mix the glue underwater, knock the corals off with chisels, and then glue them in place. These are all the different corals, quite a range. And these are the corals stuck in place. And this is just some of the monitoring results. And just a quick explanation. This is as you go from the deep 10 metres, 20 metre width of the breakwater. So this is the shallow surface, 0 to 1 metre deep. And this is 10 metres deep. And this is as you go across the breakwater. And you'll see these are natural. This is rock. The yellow is where we've transplanted coral. So that's the percentage of coral we've transplanted. And you'll notice one interesting thing here is, you see this light blue colour? This is sea urchins. And there's many sea urchins in the shallows, which is understandable because they graze on algae. But you'll see there's hardly any natural coral in the shallows. Natural coral being the red. All the natural coral occurs down here, where there's fewer urchins. So the urchins appear to be stopping the corals developing. And you can see that these are the urchins munching all the macroalgae. And so a little tiny coral that would develop, a fanny, let's call it a fanny when the corals fertilise themselves, so the eggs and sperm go up into the water column, they're fertilised. Something called a planula floats in the water, and about 2 weeks later it settles. But if it settles here, it's going to get eaten by urchins, which is why we didn't find any natural. So if we transplanted corals, they survived.
What's macroalgae?
Macroalgae is this. That's this. Algae, a phytoplankton, is a single cell, and algae is a sort of generic term, a broad term for single cells and colonies of algae. And the term macroalgae is it's so big you can see it. So these are lots and lots of cells of algae that are stuck together in groups. So it's a sort of a colony of algae. And because we see it, it's called macroalgae. So it's not a plant. It's algae, and this algae would grow wherever there's a lot of light, and because there's many urchins here that feed on the algae, but you can't see the algae here because they've eaten it all. And grazing cattle, they also eat the set of planula of the corals. So there's no corals in the shallow water. And we assess the growth rate by taking permanent photographs and then comparing from one set of monitoring to the next set. Here's a translocated coral, so we can digitise that and say, right, it's that big. And then in 6 months' time, we can see how much it's grown. This is the mortality rate, and most of the corals hardly any mortality. And this is the sensitive one. Remember when I first started speaking, I told you that the aquaporin was very sensitive. That was the one that we had the most mortality with. These are parietes, these are the brain corals. all doing very well. There's a huge capybara of rain coral here. And I won't touch on Savannah because you know all about that. There should be another. These are the tern colonies.
That's finished.
I was hoping there might be a photograph of Acropora. Yeah, the Acropora, there's a. Because it's so fast growing, you can just about see the glue on some of these, but the Acropora, the growth has been so fast that it's covered all the glue up, so we can't see that. And that was in just a few short months. That's me finished, so you can get out and tear around now. No, any questions before I... Any questions? Where do you want to go? I understand you're going to do some interviews.
Yes,
right?
After.
Yeah. Okay,
if you don't have any questions, we'll go back to the moment.